You have stepped into a mystical place, The Last Video Store, a video store that has every single film on its shelves, and I am its most humble clerk, Alexi Toliopoulos, and it is my honor to be hosting this show and bringing you into this world. Our guest this week is filmmaker Goran Stolevski. A wonderful filmmaker, and I say wonderful a lot on this show because we're treated to some truly wonderful people that earned that title. But I'd say this, he is one of my favorite filmmakers working in film, especially Australian cinema right now. His debut film was You Won't Be Alone, which is a kind of folklore horror-ish take on witchcraft in Eastern Europe, in the Balkans, a great film starring Noomi Rapace. His follow-up film, Of an Age, opened the Melbourne International Film Festival. And I'd say this, far out, dude, it might be the very best Australian film in the last 10 plus years. It is this really tender queer love story. It's a road movie. It boasts some of the most immersive, powerful performances. And his new film, which comes out on May 9th in Australian cinemas, is called Housekeeping for Beginners. And I'll say this, and I say it to him, 3 for 3, man. 3 fantastic movies. I absolutely love them. Before we get into our chat and into Goran's rental combo, let me tell you a little bit about Housekeeping for Beginners. It is a film set in Macedonia, which is where Goran comes from. And it is a very rare film because it is about the Roma people, the Romani people, and the way that they are perceived, the way that they are perceived by the rest of the world. And what is in there is this really interesting story about this family dynamic, this queer household that come together to form a new family. And it is brash, it's bustling, it's really vibrant, it's really, really strong. And it's this kind of clash of cultures and clashes of languages that what excites me most about it is that it grows in its warmth and it grows in its humor as the film progresses, which is a really unique identity for a film. I can't recommend it highly enough. I was lucky enough to see it on its Sydney premiere at the Mardi Gras Film Festival, where it closed out the whole festival. And it's a great statement. And Goran has such a huge future ahead of him. But in the present, I'll say this. He's one of the most ferocious, fearless, seeking out, hunting cinephiles that I've ever encountered. He eclipses my cinephilia by so much. So the pressure is on me today rather than on him when it comes to that rental combo. I have been stressing about it for ages, trying to think of a movie that I could even possibly recommend him that he has not seen, let alone heard of. It's high stress situation. It's a high stress situation for me to find a movie that he could like that he has not already seen. So that pressure's on to me. He's going to pick a new release film. He's going to pick 2 classics. Those are weeklies, baby. And I'm going to give him that recommendation. And if he has already seen it, God, the consequences are dire for me. Absolutely dire. But I'm going to do my best. After all, it is my duty. It is my honor. It is the code that I have sworn. Now let's get into it. Here is my chat with filmmaker of Housekeeping for Beginners, Goran Stolevski. Welcome to the video store.
Thank you. Yeah. Finally back home.
Well, you know, it's an honor to have you in here. I think you're one of the great cinephiles of this land. So it's our blessing to have you within our halls.
Thank you. Finally someone understands me.
But that makes the pressures on me today. The pressure's on me right now. I'm sweating. I got to prove my worth to you.
Oh, I like that I'm already making you sweat. It usually takes me a bit longer. But yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm an easy sweater. It's nothing on you this time.
I hope you open conversations
always
with that. Excellent.
I got no choice. I have to. I'm going to go. By the way, guys, I'm about to perspire. So if you see me leaking, Well, we're going to get to your picks in a moment, but I'm going to sign you up to the video store. Mm. I'm going to get you that card ready. I'm going to laminate it for you.
Oh, I miss these days. Like, I'm not going to leave. That's the problem. Like, I'm actually going to stay here.
We'll swap sides of the desk. You can take my job. Yeah. Goran, I'm going to need to see a piece of identification from you. I've got a beautiful monitor set up.
Oh my God. So I only am just noticing this now. Mm-hmm. Like, that's also very transporting.
We're doing time travel in every way for you.
Yeah.
We can take you back to the video store in your memories in any way that you want.
Yeah, well, I have several. Depends on which, you know, like one for each day of the week. It was the time. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to get a piece of identification to verify who you are. And here I'm seeing we've got a queer lion from Venice Film Festival Housekeeping for Beginners. Can I ask you, what is the queer lion? Is it the character from Wizard of Oz?
It's actually my pronouns. Yeah, it was pretty cool. So we're in Venice Film Festival. Like all the films in the various competition sections that have, you know, a queer element are up for this prize. And like there's a queer palm at Cannes and, you know, the Teddy Bear Award at Berlin. Mm. So in Venice, I was the gayest lion of them all.
Well, what an honor. An honor.
If that was the only award I've ever won, Teddy, in my life. Yeah. Actually, I'm not an awards driven person, but I'm like, this is a queer lion. Tell me the award is pink. It's not only pink, it's sparkly.
Sparkly and pink.
Yes.
Wow, does it
matches nothing in my house, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to redesign the whole room around it. It's fine.
That's the focal point now.
Where
does it sit in your house?
It's next to my computer, actually. So next to where I do my writing. Look, there's not much. I live in a shitty studio the size of a shoebox. Yeah. Like, it's 55 square meters. It is tiny. There's not many spaces.
So it is where it is, and it takes up almost the entire space, yes, it sounds like.
Yeah, it does.
But I was lucky enough to see your new film, Housekeeping for Beginners, yesterday. And I'm going to tell you this, brother, you're 3 for 3 with me. I love all three of your films. But I'd love to focus on this one because I think it's so rare that we see stories about Roma people or Romani people on screen, and I'm about to ask you the most basic bitch question I can. What was the genesis of this film?
I also identify as a basic bitch, so thank you. The genesis was a photo I saw posted, a friend of mine posted, who's a veteran filmmaker himself, Mr. Tony Ayers.
Mm, Homesong Stories.
Walking on Water. Homesong Stories is actually probably my favorite film of his. And he posted a photo online of when he first moved to Melbourne in the 1970s. And he moved into a house with his boyfriend and 8 queer women. And it was just a still from, you know, just a random day in their life in that house. And I was like, what a cool space. Like that sense of, you know, like a cocoon you have to yourselves to just kind of, live your life, you know, in a time and place where that was maybe a bit more complicated. But I wanted that kind of space, and I updated it to the present day. And, you know, this kind of story doesn't quite make sense in an Aussie context. But also, even putting that aside, I shifted it to Macedonia, partly, you know, I'm from there, so I know it. But partly, like, that country is very similar to, you know, 50 other countries, all of Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, and probably definitely big chunks of the Middle East.
Yeah.
Parallel, you know, cultures and socioeconomies and, you know, most queers don't really get to choose where they land. A lot of the queer people in the world weren't born into a developed economy. And I'm really, you know, those stories we don't get to see for obvious reasons. It's no one's fault, but it's still, you know, we miss out. And I think, like, if you don't document these in real time, it's like they disappear. It's like, you know, they never existed.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm verbalizing it now in retrospect, but, like, a lot of the time with ideas, it's a feeling and then, you know, kind of, things start swarming at you. It becomes like a story world based on a bunch of personalities. And it's like a 10-second, you know, process. And then you're trying to unpack it psychologically. Like, what led to that thought? And, you know, it's all talking about it in a literal linear term.
Yeah.
It's very, yeah, doesn't quite capture it, actually. But, yeah.
That's so interesting, though, because especially with each of your films, they are so distinct, like you have 3 really unique films. And I think what feels maybe most unique about this one is the way that the story like grows and develops. It almost gets warmer as it continues on and it gets more overtly comedic, it gets funnier as it goes along as well. What was the journey that you really want to take your audience on with this film?
Mm. To be honest, I don't really set out with like an emotional map. I sort of I sat with the idea for a while until, you know, enough scenes and details accumulated before I sat down and wrote it. Like, as in, for years, it was just at the back of my head. You know, I didn't really sit down to write it. And then, yeah, it's just this web of relationships. And, you know, I wanted it to sort of encompass every feeling. You know, I didn't want it to be just sad or just funny. I definitely wanted to prioritize the comedy because, you know, it's a pretty dark premise. But I think, you know, no one's life is a social realist drama every day. Even in the direst of circumstances, even in the middle of wartime, you know, you still, just to survive, you're trying to, like, live some in a way that there is some joy or, like, you know, moments of emotional, like, solace or succor. You know, and I think, and I wanted to kind of seek out those moments, partly because they're true to life, but partly because I've seen the rest. I've seen gay misery, God knows, over and over. It's not very interesting. Not sure how much it was ever, but it definitely isn't anymore in and of itself as a goal. Or just in general, European, you know, misery porn. It's like its own genre, I feel.
It absolutely is. Right? It's a broad genre. There's lots of different types of European misery.
But there's but a certain kind that is like the exploitative. Yes. I'm like, I can tell you went to private school, and yet you're like really going to talk to me about the misery of poor people. Thank you. Really want to learn about that.
That poverty porn.
Yeah. It's up there with superhero movies in terms of my favorite genres. I find them equally intellectually and emotionally stimulating, actually. So I definitely didn't want to go in that direction.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, you steered quite clear of it with this one. I want to talk about that web of relations we're talking about. Let's get stuck in that web, because when I think about like the evolution of your films, it's almost like with Of an Age, it's an ensemble of three characters with like three really powerful, strong performances with like really clear to the audience perspectives. This one, you feel like it's almost like a level up where you have this entire big ensemble of lively cast characters. Can you talk about working in that ensemble and calibrating it and the challenges of it?
Yeah, for sure. To be honest, actually, with each of the first two films, like, I think the way the story and visual style is constructed, you kind of, you know, feel there's obviously the main characters that are in focus. So it doesn't quite feel like an ensemble effort. But if you go back to You Won't Be Alone, those scenes are very densely populated. There's 12 people, and usually they're not extras, they're actors, most of them, you know. And when you're on set, everyone's a human being. It's not like this is the person that's my focus and the rest figure their shit out, you know. I'm used to directing ensembles from moment one, you know, of day one of You Won't Be Alone. And to me, even the actor who has two lines in the background genuinely shapes the performance of the main character. A lot of the time, direction I give on set is about making sure the protagonist is focusing not on themselves, but on the people around them and engaging with them. So in terms of on a day-to-day level, it was no different because I always was working with like scenes with 10 people. The wedding preparation scene in Of an Age has like 10 people, you know, running around with dialogue, and it's all there. It's just the emotional focus is with the guys.
Yeah.
And with Hattie, of course, I mean, Ebony, the character.
Yeah.
So focusing on those three. Like emotionally, that's what you experience. I think the problem then is like that a lot of people miss out on how much heavy lifting is done by the character actors because without them, that reality doesn't feel real. You know, one of my favorite characters in Of an Age was the bridesmaid who's like, I mean, that's actually my friend. She improvised at one point, you know, after the dance scenes, she's just like, gays are just the best dancers. Like, I've seen documentaries. It's just amazing what you guys like. And, I wish I could have had the close up, but like, you know, for where the way the story was flowing, I couldn't quite. You make it there, but it's there. Yeah. But like, if without those moments, that film isn't like quite as funny. And like, I still love having people ask me about like, so how did you come with the dialogue at the wedding? It felt so real. I'm like, you should meet Julia Harari. I was lucky enough to meet her at a young age, and I know if you just let her loose, you get gold. And then it was similar in this, like on a day-to-day level, like there's differences in terms of making sure you get, you know, camera angle coverage, and I'm not going to bore you shitless about that. But the dynamic, like, it needs to work in real time on the day. And for that, you need to be paying attention to everyone and be nurturing of them all, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, and also, this cast, it's, you know, multilingual. Was that a challenge, like, through trying to, like, get everyone on the same page, or?
It didn't feel like it on the day. Like, definitely in the lead up, you know, it was, I mean, our two lead actresses, you know, like I've said in the past, had to learn all of the dialogue phonetically. You know, it's not their native language. And then, you know, we had also other languages on screen that some of us didn't speak, you know. It was actually really a gently flowing, well, not gently, chaotically somehow flowing. It was a warm
feeling.
It
was flowing, however it'd be chaotic or gentle.
It was never, you know, we had a great time every day. Like, and, you know, that's really rare on set. So it was, you know, but it was constant, it was intense and it was constant chaos in some ways. But, like, we were getting a lot of, you know, everything on, you know, was coming together. And there was, you know, new bits of improv and little scenes. And, like, we finished early in the end because of that. But I think everyone kind of, like, what was great, I think in retrospect, I realized that everyone, both cast and crew, weren't operating based on, I've been given another task and I'm going to do this and that's the end of the task. Like, I think we all pictured what the film is at the end and also what the reality is in terms of the world of these characters. And you're operating within it. And, you know, even if there's little bits that are a bit challenging, because, like, what did they just say? They're improvising a language none of us speak. You trust that they're doing their job. You can kind of have a sense. And also, you know, I don't know what they're saying, and they're speaking to each other. And, like, in real life, these characters wouldn't know what they're saying. You know, so you embrace that reality. I would say chaotically yet smoothly is how it all worked. And I genuinely miss it. Like, I want to go back to that set. Wow. We all do.
So I guess it's all about trying to find the authenticity of it all. It's like where you go for
it. It's instinctively, I think you're chasing it. It's really easy to find it if you're just open to it.
Wow. That's a beautiful lesson, everyone. It's easy to find it.
Yeah.
Take that with
it's
you.
It's there.
Well, Goran, the film comes out on May 9th in Australia.
Yes.
So hopefully very soon when this is coming out into the world as well.
Wonderful.
And I do think everyone should go see it. Housekeeping for Beginners.
I think everyone should go see it as well.
I think
I agree with you.
It should be the law. I think everyone has to go see
it.
And if not, they'll have to freaking deal with me, dude.
I mean, I'm petrified for them because of that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm one of the toughest blokes around, so watch out, guys.
Oh my God.
Well, we've signed you up to the store. I'm going to send you out to go pick up your little rental combo. And the new members combo is, of course, one new release, two weeklies. And then it will be my duty, my honor, and my greatest fear to provide you with a customized, bespoke staff pick recommendation based on everything I know about you.
Yeah.
I'm using empathy today.
Excellent. Oh, wow. A strength, I hear. Yeah.
One of my great strengths is I can see people and I can feel them and I can understand who they are.
And all of this for $11.99.
$11.99, yes. And I pay you the $11.99. That's how this store works.
Finally, income.
And it's film-related income, so you do have to declare it.
Yeah. No, good. Excellent.
Well, I'll send you out. Go pick up those picks and come on back.
Right.
New release.
All right, your new release film, Goran. I'm going to tell you this. I'm excited to talk about this movie because this was almost a pick that I almost gave as a recommendation for a previous guest, my dear friend Nina Oyama.
Oh my God, Nina.
Yeah, she was there last night as well.
I know. I mean, we know each other. So yeah, we had a chat quickly.
And so, you know, we can pass it on to her afterwards. Maybe you can watch it with her when you take it back home.
I might see her tonight. I might tell her to watch it then.
Tell her. Absolutely tell her.
Okay.
The movie is Return to Seoul.
Drama.
Can you tell me about Return to Seoul?
Well, I think it's a French production primarily, but all of it takes place in Korea. And the lead character and actress, a French-Korean woman who grew up in France, and I'll speak about the character, but like she was adopted and kind of grew up very disconnected from Korean culture, or essentially, or from the country itself, and almost on a whim ends up in Seoul. And almost on a whim decides she's going to try and track down her birth parents through, like, you know, it's not even like a convoluted bureaucracy, but, you know, there's natural obstacles that are in place to protect, you know, everyone's emotional well-being.
Yeah.
And
I think that's a really exciting thing about the movie is, like, there are bureaucratic obstacles, but they feel like they do translate to emotional obstacles as a viewer.
Absolutely. And no one's demonized along the way. Mm. It's a very human film. And also, I really love, like, in case it's not clear from my work, I really love characters who are abrasive, who are not trying to be likable. Because I find, I relate to them. And also,
you're likable, let it be known. Let the record show.
It's all a lie. It'll break down in 20 minutes. No, but I think those people are more interesting to watch, and they tell me more about humanity. I think the idealized wish fulfillment lie of a likable protagonist is just not my kind of jam. Mm. And I'm pretty sure this was the actress's first performance.
First performance, right? And the actor's name is Park Ji-min.
Yeah.
First performance, and just stunning performance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you know, very fearless, very, you know, committed, you know, mind and body and soul to this story.
My favorite term to use, it's a raw performance.
Well, I mean, it is. It's not a lie to say
it. I know, but I love to say it.
Yeah.
And I think what really works with this film is that it's so beautifully in line with the perspective of its protagonist, where you just, like, you really do inhabit them. You really do see the world from them, and just allows every emotional beat, every moment of, like, the emotional turmoil that she's in, like that existentiality of dealing with who are you and where are you from. You feel those so deep in this film.
And it's interesting that, like, there's probably five different times within it that it could have ended and it would have been a great film. But it's the thing is, like, and usually when that happens, I'm like, okay, you should have just picked one, you know? But, like, we don't have to go Lord of the Rings in every film. But, like... In this case, you know, I thought the film was about to end, and then it went to a different sequence, and then it just deepened even more.
Mm.
And then again, I thought, like, oh, this must be close to the ending, and then something else happened. And, you know, it's never that, like, my attention was lagging at all. I just felt, like, so emotionally kind of full. And then it would build and deepen and build and deepen over and over again. You know, I felt like I'd kind of got all what you could get out of watching a great novel, you know, when I was watching this movie. I mean, reading a great novel. there's a book I watched recently.
And a lot of people listen to books, but you're the first to watch them. It's very exciting.
Powers. So I just love that it had that depth while being, you know, it's not, I mean, you know, there's lots of dialogue, but it's not just like a talky film. It's not just an intellectual exercise. It all feels very felt. And cinematic, like the craft is, you know, superb all through and very organic. And I'm just so grateful for any movie that can hold my attention, frankly. And because I'm just jaded, man. Yeah. It's been like, I've kept track of how many films I've watched since like 7,000, I think, by now. So,
wow, okay.
Yeah. Like, even good films right now, I'm just like, you know, there's nothing you're doing wrong, but can you speed it up? I'm tired.
I think that's the cinephile's curse. There's always going to be peaks and valleys where you're like, sometimes I go, I love everything. And then there's moments I go, the only movie I like is Beverly Hills Cop, and I just need to keep watching that over and over again. It's the only thing that does something for me.
You're right. Mine are really weird, but like, actually, Return to Soul, I probably could watch over and over again because it's, even though it's not the kind of film you'd associate with it. But yeah, no, I was just, you know, I felt like I was living someone's life and it, you know, someone was very different from me in so many ways, but like, it kind of felt connected to my own life as well.
It's like that, the connection you get from specific, like something being specific.
Completely.
It's that's how you find like the universality. It's like through specific.
Exactly. It's almost like a cliche to say, and you wonder if people just put it in publicity materials just to say something, but genuinely
it works.
You see it demonstrated.
And I didn't know it was a cliche. I thought it was the first person ever to say that out loud.
You can edit that out. Who's editing?
We're going to put a little note that says first time these words were ever said in human history.
Maybe just like do the whole like sense bleep me out and go, he was just swearing his fucking ass off.
And if
anyone's seen my films, they would not be surprised if I started swearing my ass off blithely.
It was a blue episode. He was swearing. He was screamed at me the whole time. The film is Return to Seoul, David Chu. The other thing I'd say about it is I absolutely love like nocturnal films. I think this film captures that Korean Seoul nightlife with like such vibrancy where you do feel that energy, like the way that almost social interaction changes as it gets darker and more into night. I think that's something that's really evocative about this. And also those temporal shifts when you start seeing different you see these people catch up in their lives further on in their life.
You can imagine I'd be like emotionally.
Of an age, of course, similar to that.
Like, yes, this is the Ken story I love.
Yeah, but the director is Davey Chu. I cannot wait to see what they do next. And
absolutely.
Return to Seoul, great movie. Yeah. And I'll say you return to my soul right now. What a wonderful pick from you.
Well, it's what I'm here for.
Before we get into your weekly picks, I actually want to ask you, and I think it is my duty to do so, I have to ask you, have you ever been a member of another video store? Any other video memories?
Oh my God. I think there was probably like 14 video 14 stores that I had a membership
of. Wow.
Well, you know, I was a hardcore nerd, film nerd, you know, so initially, like, I wasn't, you know, my family couldn't afford to be a member of video stores, so I just used public libraries up until the point where, like, I just used them all up. I then discovered, I think what is now the Acme Collection in Melbourne used to be called Cinemedia, and I found out that if you paid a $55 membership annually, you could have, like, endless, you know, you could borrow, have four films a week, and it had everything, like, you know, every Bergman movie, every Fellini movie. And that was my annual birthday present for 2 years for my parents. Even though my birthday was in July, I only got one expensive thing a year, and that was that.
Yeah.
And it was worth it. And especially because I remember at one point they mixed up the fact that I was ordering too many videos. So I was getting 8 a week, and no one knew. And I'm like, yeah, keep them coming. It's fine. So that was the first one, but then, progressively, there were some films I could find in various video stores, and,
before you moved to Australia, did you go to video stores?
No, I don't think they existed, to be honest, in my town, or if there were, they just were very short-lived things with just mainly pirated porn onto VHS.
We do have a section of pirated porn as well, but it's in the basement. It's a trap door.
That's one of my weekly picks, actually. And I used to work in a video store. So Video Easy Rosanna, this is Garen, was something I used to say on the phone a lot for 2 years.
Wow, you wore the uniform. You're a man in uniform like myself.
Oh my God, a shitty blue shirt. I, you know, and then there's the loop tape playing, like, it's an hour-long program with, you know, trailers and random video clips of bad pop, and you just listen to it 6 times a day, 5 days a week, and you just want to stab either yourself or all of humanity by the end of it, but, but I got to work in a video store, so it was worth it.
If you want, I can give you the loop tape as one of your extra picks. You can take the loop tape from here.
No, I've experienced it enough. Trust me. It lives on in my blood. There's no need to revisit that one.
Oh, man. Loop tape? I've not thought about loop tapes in so long.
I still have nightmares.
Absolutely. I always used to just be like, when I had those moments by myself where there was no one else in the store, to just take the loop tape away and start putting in something else just to, like, escape it all.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much of a choice I had to do that, but, like, I do remember, like, why was Rock Lobster playing for 2 months at the Video Easy loop tape in 2006? Can that, like, there are mysteries in life. I feel like there's a premise in that somewhere.
Yeah, there's an investigation.
Rock Lobster needs to be promoted more in 2006. In suburban video stores in Melbourne.
Well, it works for me. It's one of my favorite songs, and now I have the answer as to why it was.
It was, Kismet, obviously. It was meant to be. I need to never hear that song again, but that's not the song's fault.
Weekly. We're going to move on to your weekly picks. Mm. And you got a lovely little stack here. Two favorites of mine. And also two, like, wonderful queer auteurs. George Cukor's film.
Oh, shit, right.
The Philadelphia Story.
Pushing the gay agenda.
Absolutely. Exactly. We're going to have to announce this episode. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
Then we've got George Cukor's classic comedy, screwball romantic, The Philadelphia Story.
Comedy.
Yes.
And the beautiful Criterion Collection edition
This is so cool. I think I have... Oh, no, I've got it on DVD, but I don't think it's the Criterion, so...
Well, you can't have that one.
Need to move on.
You can only borrow it. You can only loan it.
It's fine. I'll test it. I'll test it on it here, and then I'll order it.
What made you pick this film?
This is a film I could watch over and over again, and have, actually. Although not a lot recently, actually, now that I think of it. But, I feel like... You know, that's one of the peaks in all art of all time ever. Like, Hollywood screwball comedy in the 30s and 40s is as high level. I know it's popular art, but it's as high level art as, you know, Da Vinci, as far as I'm concerned. And I adore Da Vinci. That's not a knock.
Yeah, the Da Vinci Code.
I'm not gonna come
about.
Here and knock Leonardo da Vinci. Like,
yeah.
No, I think like the level of writing that happened and the level of acting. I think it's really ironic that like when I watched the Philadelphia Story, I believe all of those people have actually had sex in real life. Mm-hmm. When I watch, you know,
in
any
different combinations,
Catherine
Heigl even in
or whatever movie, I'm like, I'm not sure anyone has.
Yeah, you
know? It's really weird because it's a very conservative time. I remember. There used to be a rule that people weren't allowed to be seen kissing on screen for longer than 3 seconds.
Mm. And that's so, the Hayes part of the Hayes Code?
Yes. Yeah. You know, obviously they had to be fully clothed and all this, but I'm just like, but they're so like, you know, I feel like these people have lived lives and had relationships and like there's sex that's been had and they're adults about it, you know? Whereas now I feel like we're so coy about this shit in a very juvenile way. And yeah, like all you know, I didn't have friends in high school. Katharine Hepburn was my best friend.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that to complain. I'm saying that to show off. And Cary Grant made me gay, but that was through bringing a baby, not through this one. Although it may have compounded it.
Of course. You know. It takes two, I say. It takes two versions of the same guy.
I've seen many versions of him by that point. So, yeah, no, I love this film. And speaking of, you know, ensemble, it's just like every single person on screen. There's Ruth Hussey is one of the supporting characters.
Absolutely.
And, like, you know, children on screen are so often annoying, but Virginia Weidler in this is not. Mm. Like, it's every single person in relationship is thought through and developed, and there's just not an ounce of fat on in that movie.
And those three primary leads of Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, there is, like, that really palpable, fun chemistry tension that makes every moment of dialogue just sing so harmoniously between
and
them.
And I remember someone in a review pointing out how, like, ages ago, it stuck with me, like, it's rare that you watch a romantic comedy and you genuinely don't know which guy the lead is going to end up with, or even who you're rooting for in the end. That is remarkable.
Like, and you love to see it play out in this one. Like
you
really
actually
do.
Don't know how it's going to end because it's plausible that it could go either direction. Mm. Like, and I think, you know, there's a satisfying version of each of those. And the ending on screen is definitely extremely satisfying. But no, it's really rare. And yeah, I adore it. And like, you know, Go the gays. Go George Cukor. I forgot that it was him.
Yeah. He's such an interesting filmmaker because his impact on Hollywood and like that golden era of Hollywood filmmaking is so apparent. And you see it kind of trickle down a lot between him and Howard Hawks, that idea of like that
my
fast
other favorite
pace.
Man.
Fast pace, like cross-talking dialogue. Mm. It's still kind of alive today in a lot of like comedy. Like I think my access point to these back in my video store days was the sitcom It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Right.
And like seeing and becoming really obsessed as a teenager with that, the idea of that overlapping dialogue, that jokes just keep rolling into each other, and it's about the fast-paced delivery of them. Mm. And so from there, I was like, well, where does that start? And as a teenager, I'm like, okay, let me go back. Let me go through the archives.
Yeah, it was the same year as His Girl Friday, which is like overlapping dialogue on steroids to the max, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was, I think that was Howard Hawks.
That was Hawks, yeah.
And it was Cary Grant. He, like, what a year that guy had.
I know, right?
And yeah, absolutely. And I think it's... I actually feel like Josh Cukor doesn't get the, you know, respect that he deserves. A lot of the time, because the direction isn't showy, so because you almost have to be a genre director to be seen as visible. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no understanding of how handling relationships on screen and characters, like, with finesse, doesn't get the recognition because it's not like an easy thing to spot,
especially because it's also comedic, and I think comedic stuff and comedic performances is even of this era they get dismissed a lot. But
completely,
he was such a director that was great with actors and a real ally to actors and bring out great performances. And also, I think you're right with the genre thing because he is a bit of a journeyman filmmaker because he did this. His first one with Katharine Hepburn, I think, was the Little Women adaptation.
Which is the best one.
I love that one, but I can't co-sign if it's the best one. I think...
You don't have to. I can guarantee it is.
That's not a knock. I actually really loved Greta Gerwig's one as well.
What about Mervyn LeRoy? You big Mervyn LeRoy fan?
He's version of it? That one is a piece of shit. We don't have to pretend.
I like the Psycho Little Girl, but that's it. but then also, you know, he did A Star Is Born as well. Yeah. So he's just
He did a lot. He even did all the best parts of Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. You know, like he had amazing visual panache as well when, you know, given the scope. Like, I think it's really genuinely like people don't seem to respect. And also, if you work on feminine, like I think if you do films about violent men, you get instant respect because male violence is seen as automatically profound, whereas relationships and feelings are not. And my feeling is always the opposite, you know? I mean, like, I know if we take out violent men from the Australian filmography, there'll be like four films left.
Yeah.
So
it's an area of fascination.
I can't possibly question that.
Yeah, exactly. You ruin our canon. I can't do it.
Yeah, our canon bores me shitless. But thank God for like The Piano and Hanging Rock and Muriel's Wedding, you know? And there's a few good ones.
There's a few that sneak through.
But yeah. But no, like, I actually think it comes down to that. I think, like, anything that's, you know, associated with femininity is somehow seen as, like, less profound, whereas I'm just like, emotional intelligence is actually much more interesting than, like, violence, you know?
Yeah.
So, and much more relevant to most people's lives.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think with this film as well, in that moment in history when we're thinking about, like, that Hays Code, that weird era where things are trying to be provocative through like whatever means they can be. This film is about a divorce, and it's about a divorce in a really interesting way where it's a divorced couple that eventually must get back together somehow. And it's kind of interesting to go back and revisit these films and see how society even interpreted something that's so normal and commonplace now. Like, you know, I've got maybe four friends that have parents that are still together. And it's then it was like, oh, we have to get these people back together because they made that promise to themselves years ago. But it does it in a way that's so fun. It's so exciting. Yeah. And I'd say this to the listener as well. If you have not made the exploration back to older films, like Golden Age films, I actually think this is a really great access point.
It's very accessible.
Open those gates for you and walk through and just experience something, you know, it's really fun. It's so watchable.
And just really, really good writing. So you know what, like, I don't think people who haven't seen films before the 50s know what good dialogue actually is, genuinely. Watch this and All About Eve and then talk to me about writing. Like, before that, we're not talking. I'm sorry. Yeah.
The other one from this era that I love, same team basically, I love Holiday.
Holiday. Yeah, absolutely. That was the same year as Bringing Up Barry. So like that had a good run.
That had a good run. Well, let's move on to your next weekly pick. An all-time favorite for me. One of my favorite filmmakers. Perhaps actually my favorite filmmaker. We've got Pedro Almodovar's Volver.
Drama.
How much am I allowed to go into spoiler territory with this one?
Let's go into it. I mean, it's been out for like, all 18 years?
18 years. Like, is it safe to come out now? Yeah.
It's of age. We can spoil it if we want. But maybe we'll give a little.
One of the pleasures. Actually, no, I'm not going to spoil it. Because if someone hasn't seen it, like, there's just an element that you've just taken for granted for the entire film. And then there's a casual conversation where something's revealed towards the end. And you're like, Oh, of course. And it really plays on how, you know, it's not a meta statement or anything, but it really plays about how we engage with movies and we just accept what's being told to us in a certain way, in a way that we never would in real life. And then, you know, the characters within the story are obviously playing it out in real life. So it means one thing to them and then it means this other thing to us. And towards the end, these things come together. And this just like casually beautiful and wise conversation that happens. And I just remember being so enthralled with that film that then it ends almost moments after that. And just like, I'm like, no, it can't be over. I'm not ready to say goodbye. I like started like tearing up just because like, no, how could it have finished? It was so like, I mean, it's the perfect ending. But it's just, like it's so satisfying. And so, and again, I think because it's not about male violence, it doesn't quite get the same recognition.
But there is a moment of violence and a man does pop it. There's a man that does pop it in there.
Yeah, but, you know, because female feelings are seen as somehow like gossipy and chatty. But I'm just like, no, this film is profound.
Yes.
And again, about a certain way of living. Like, I think he's one of the only humanist filmmakers, deeply humanist filmmakers left. And just even, you know, the villain, for lack of a better term, in the piece has layers that are revealed, and the attitudes of the characters have multiple contradictory stances. And speaking of a web of relationships, it's immaculate, you know, and every single performance mattering, and every single character mattering, and, you know, dark, extremely dark premise, but with, it's a joyous, you know, vibrant film.
Vibrant is the word, truly, for this, because it's like, it's that idea that he uses melodrama to communicate to you through, like, emotions, and to, like, really get to them. Like, can I ask you, is this your favorite Pedro film?
No, it's so hard to say which one that is.
Favorite is like a seven movies that I shift around.
It's, and it, you know, like, yeah.
Today it is.
If, between this and Talk to Her, it's hard for me to decide, to be honest.
Wow, I would say that's very different pretty films. Close to my top two as well. Because Talk to Her is also a film that you could never, ever make again. Like, it is for many, many reasons. But it's just, even like, I didn't know how you could show that film to a young person without giving them, like, heaps of context to it. But Volver, I think what is really special about it is that Pedro touch. And it's that idea that this movie begins in a place of some kind of magical realism. And then it quickly just goes, no, there isn't. And you go, oh, okay. And it kind of, the way that that film plays with that, I don't think I've ever seen another film
Actually, this, while being very, you know, conventionally accessible as a storytelling, it's doing extremely unique things, which is so rare. You know, he's I think the greatest filmmaker alive, for sure. And I love that he's still making films. You know, like Pain and Glory was beautiful.
One of my favorite movies the last 5 years. Parallel Mothers he did just after that.
Yeah, that was a great film. That's like his 10th best film, and it was still one of the best films of that year. You know,
I put it as my number one of that year.
That's the thing. Like, even he's like, I mean, what would be, like, a lesser effort is filmography is, like, one of the greatest efforts in most people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. And there's something else you said when you were talking about Volver's, like, the idea of perfect ending. And I think across the board, he's a filmmaker that truly understands it more than the audience where a film should end. Like, or more than the audience's feelings should know where a film to end. And I think that what he, I mean, I think most filmmakers know better than the audience, but, you know, when you're watching it,
debatable, depends which films you're watching.
When you're watching it, you find that satisfaction of going like, oh, I had no idea where this would go. But he takes you there and he brings you in there. When I think about Pain and Glory, that's ending where you go, when you it recontextualizes what you've been watching.
Oh my God, I just remember the closing images.
Those closing images.
And it's also when the emotional impact lands really hard. Somehow something that's been building and you don't even realize it all along, when it lands in the closing frames, the same way it did for Volver. And same with Pain and Glory. It was just suddenly, and especially with that film, because it's so clearly personal to him and autobiographical. And,
He said it's not autobiographical.
There's aspects of this. He said some aspects
it's in his kitchen. The film's set in his kitchen for the most part. But Volver, if people haven't seen it, I don't even know how really to describe it, but it's a melodrama, Spanish melodrama, where about three generations of women and I don't even know where to begin.
It's like, about trying to live your day-to-day life, you know, on limited means while trying to cover up a murder and reconnect with your dead parent.
Perfectly put.
There we go.
And then from there where it takes
you. Fabulous.
Fabulous. A fabulous grandmother. It's I just really love this movie. I was so glad to see you pick it. It's just, you know, that Penelope Cruz performance as well. It's her big, well, she was a star, but it was that big breakthrough at that time of people in America and around the world, like, seeing her.
Oh, she can act, yeah.
Yeah, seeing her in her, like, natural language as well, just, like, breakthrough. And it's just, I don't know, I think it's, when you, Penelope Cruz is one of my very favorite actors.
Oh, I would, like, I would just, you know, I'd be an assistant on set, I will carry her water or whatever she needs me to carry. Like, I'm happy to just be the intern and just watch. It's fine. I adore her. And I have, like, and she was very important to me, like, through that decade of, you know, I guess when you're in your mid-20s and going to the cinema religiously, like, that was, you know, I wouldn't say the peak of her career, because, you know, her career is still going quite well.
She's still on the peak, it feels like. We're on the ascent.
So, but, you know, she was very important to me in those key years, and remains important to me, actually. So, yeah.
Can I ask you, like, with the dynamic that we're talking about of Pedro's films, of, like, it being these, you know, the, a lot of them are about families. Did you see a lot of, like, your own family in them? Because when I see your films as well, there is that similar dynamic of that feeling, that feeling of when you get
it wasn't conscious, but it was really funny because I'm almost like, oh, I wish my family was like that. And then actually when You Won't Be Alone, my first feature premiered in Macedonia, I had a friend from Poland who was around. He was the, one of the financiers of Housekeeping, actually. And then all my aunts were there at the premiere. And afterwards, he was like, God, your family is like a Pedro Almodovar movie. Even like the clothes they were wearing and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, really? And I had to stop and think and go, oh my God, yeah. And a lot of, I think, and also Spanish rural is not that different from Macedonian rural.
Yeah, and same Greek mentality. Rural is for me.
Yeah, you know? Like even just the way they're cleaning those graves in the opening scene of Volver.
Oh God, how are we not talking about that? That's the best moment of the movie. But and like, then it gets better from the first image.
That was every Sunday when I was going to the grave. Like that wasn't something that I hadn't seen before. No, that was really it's not unusual.
The
like,
true resonance.
It's the same culture in that sense, for
I
sure.
I remember my grandmother going to my grandfather's grave, my papu's grave, with like this water bowl and a little chuck swipe and just pouring water to like clean the stone, and that's how this movie begins. It's so real, so authentic, but then the way that he makes it funny is you see the whole row of all the women doing the exact same thing, but it's just the way that he makes it cinematic is so fun, and that's the vibrancy.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, you describe it and it sounds like, oh great, they're creating cleaning graves, but it's actually, yeah, it's vibrant and it's fun. There's nothing, it's not a sad moment or a sad image, it's playful.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, that's exactly it. I think... it's very aesthetically conservative to just go, oh, we're talking about death, so it has to be bleak, you know? No, like, I think if you have a healthy relationship to life, you know, it's not like that. And I think, actually, you know, my brain is probably also shaped by having grown up on a lot of our films. So, you know, I'm very prepped to love them, you know, when they come out, because I've been shaped by them.
That's same here, man. And I think as well, when you see, like, and I think it's Housekeeper speaks to this as well of, like, that... European, Mediterranean, and Eastern European cultures, while like, you know, they you can be seen as patriarchal, but when you access it further or when you're in it, you truly do realize it's matriarchal
culture. It's a complex. Yeah.
It's complicated. Contradictory. Fully contradictory.
I had this conversation yesterday, like, there were like wonderfully a bunch of, queer Balkan people, young people, at the Sydney premiere of Housekeeping for Beginners last night. And we were talking about this specifically, about how, like, it's really ironic that in these patriarchal cultures, you know, especially across Southern Europe, like, women also have this other strong role. And, like, I mean, I could even speak, like, in terms of, like, Yugoslavia specifically, like, it was really normal for the woman to be the highest earner in the family or in the household. Like, just Macedonia, which I would not consider progressive when it comes to gender dynamics, has 52% of our scientists are female. The world average is 13%. Like, Australia is about 16%. So, like, I mean, Macedonia has the highest proportionally, but, like, and this isn't even something you'd observe as unusual or, like, that even take pride in, you know? And it's a weird contradiction because in so many ways it's an extremely patriarchal culture, and the gender roles are very limited, and it's complicated to talk about feminism or progress or any of these things, never mind about queerness, but it doesn't, it's not, it's never quite linear, you know, in terms of just because this aspect is happening doesn't mean this other aspect isn't also happening. So,
beautifully put.
Was it? I feel like I phrased that really badly.
Well, we'll edit it so it phrases that perfectly. We'll do an AI. We'll do an AI run through on it. Staff pick. We have come to this point in the episode where
it's your time to shine.
I'm sweating, man, because, you know, I would say of all the people that I know about, the people that are potentially walking through those doors of this store, I would say you would be in the top percentile voraciousness in cinephilia. You even dropped, you've seen 7,000 movies that you've kept track of. Yeah. I don't know, my estimate is I'm probably in that 5,000 area.
You'll get there, kid.
That means I've got a lifetime too. I've got at least one more year left. You're much younger than me.
It's different.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying. You're doing well. So I did go hunting to find you a staff pick recommendation, and I was trying to think of like where I could even go. Like, what were the options? So I had to go to find something that's like quite rare, quite underseen.
All right.
And I'm actually sweating right now. Something's changed in my body. Everything's been hunky-dory until now, and now there's like an electricity going through me in
just
the wrong way.
Just like, it's like a Band-Aid. It's fine. Okay.
Well, yeah. I'm going to put the stakes on the table right now. This is my sole duty as a video store clerk. I've returned to this world. I've taken the omerta. I've taken the honor. I've taken the code. And if this is not a good recommendation for you, I'm putting it right now. I will snap the disc in half and use it to commit harakiri upon myself.
I mean, harakiri, like the 1962 Japanese.
Yes, that is a wonderful film as well. And I have seen it, so.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay, yeah. A moment of relief for me.
Let me see what else am I seeing.
Okay, well, allow me to describe the film to you first. Mm. And I would just, it's an Australian New Wave film.
Okay.
Underseen, very underseen. And it's a road movie.
Okay.
So is this it's
Priscilla. No, sorry.
Yeah. Priscilla. Underseen. It's gay. But it's and I'll describe to you this way. It's like a road movie that has those feelings of like European cinema, like that intellectual European cinema, like Antonioni would describe it as. It evokes those same feelings of visual and narrative poetry, that cinematic slow rhythmic style.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of start building this complex portrait of a man in relation to his surroundings, like the environment around him. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was onto a winner because I even went onto Letterboxd and I saw only 80 people have seen it.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's probably.
But then when I saw some of the people I had, I go, well, these are some of my comrades in Melbourne that would have seen it at the same screening that maybe if you have seen it, you would have. But it's a film from 1979 from director Esben Storm, a filmmaking hero of mine, called In Search of Anna.
Art House.
Well done. I've never even heard of this film.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
And I've got to watch it.
Wow. Here, you can have a take it in your hands.
This is like solid work on your behalf.
Wow. Oh my God. Okay. I feel a new elation.
And of course, Bill Hunter's in it.
Bill Hunter's in it, of course.
Yeah.
But I would describe this film, it's kind of like this beautiful trip.
He's in Cannes. I love that. Okay. So there was this beautiful film that was in Cannes in the Australian New Wave. And I've done approximately 78 university degrees in film studies, and this one never came up. Like
it was totally buried. Totally buried outside the box.
Like, how come it doesn't come up in film school? You know,
it's kind of lost at the moment. Like, there has been. I'm really glad we're getting to talk about it because I think it's ripe for resurgence and ripe for rediscovery now. It did screen at the 2022 Melbourne International Film Festival in their program about Melbourne on screen.
Oh right, I remember that section. Yep.
And there was a few other great films in there. Love and Other Catastrophes amongst them. But this is a film that really, it's really rarely seen. I know one of the people involved with, like a former collaborator of Esben Storm, the filmmaker, who sadly passed away a few years ago. The collaborator, Hayden Keenan, another great filmmaker. He's been working on some kind of restorative print of it. And it screened at a film festival in Sydney last year at the Bondi Wood Film Festival. But it's a really, it's kind of also entwined across like these temporal spaces where the main character, played by the wonderful Richard Moore, is newly released from prison and he's going on search for like a lost love of his to connect to her again. But it's kind of set across different temporal spaces that entwine instead of them being separated. Mm-hmm. You see him at different points, and it's that kind of Antonioni feeling where you have to be present. And it's more about like the emotional journey, the emotional arc of the character and how that makes sense across the structure. Mm. And it's actually might be before your time in Australia, but Esben Storm was the creator and director and writer of the Australian TV series Around the Twist, which is like highly influential.
I know of it. Yeah. It was before my time.
It's maybe my favorite piece of anything ever. Like it's, especially amongst Australian comedians, it's like a central text to them all. And in this film, Richard Moore is also the dad in Around the Twist. They have the same first name. And he also says the words "round the twist" in this, like in succession. So it's like when I was watching, I go, "Okay, I'm in. I'm already in there." Yeah, he also plays a Greek guy, so I love that. Yeah. And there's this way that the camera paints the film that is—it's really kind. It has that empathy, but in a cold way. So it kind of has like this emotional reverberation.
Or I think you could describe Antonio Uni that way.
Exactly.
Empathy, but in a cold way.
In a cold way. So it's like, it's something that feels so rare in Australia to see it that way. And it's those long stretches where you kind of see moments on the road and you're actually hearing the radio, the original Double J before it even became Triple J, playing like...
Is that real?
Yeah, that's Double true. It was Double J first, and they got an extra J, they put it on there.
Next thing is Triple J 5.1.
Yeah. But you're hearing like classics, contemporary of that time, from the Angels, AC/DC, Rose Tattoo, when it's like the currency of that time. Like that's the music that's shaping Australian culture. And what's really interesting about this was Esmond Storm had already won an AFI award for this really neorealist type film about an alcoholic called 27A. That's like, it's verite, basically, this film. It's so real. And he noticed at this time, the way the new wave was continuing to crash was it's all like Picting at Hanging Rock, these period pieces, these like classical looking films. He wanted to make something really fresh and really contemporary. And that's what's brought him to In Search of Anna.
I'm almost surprised to hear like a verite Australian film. That's really not our strength, or like something that we've invested in very much as a culture or as an industry. So
yeah, it's
cool.
That and Kenny are the two, the two verite Australian films. Fair. But that's it. That's your selection. You've got Return to Seoul.
Amazing.
You've got Volver. You've got The Philadelphia Story. And my God, my successful staff pick recommendation.
I mean, I was even getting nervous for you, to be honest. Fuck, so, like, I'm really glad this has worked out.
I think I'm going to be bestowed a medal of some kind.
I think you should be, yeah.
Can I have the Queer Lion?
I mean, I'll find you something else pink and sparkly. The Queer Lion has to stay in my house. I get too much of my sense of identity from it now.
Okay, fair enough. But you won the Queer Lion once again for Housekeeping for Beginners. It is either in cinemas now or in cinemas soon. May 9th is its release. And I'm giving it my highest recommendation. I loved it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Everyone watches it.
And as soon as I earned that medal, you called me sir. Thank God. it's official. I've been knighted. Thanks so much, Goran, for joining me on the show.
Thank you.
The Last Video Store.
Well, I freaking did it, dude. I actually can't believe I survived this episode with my skin intact and my pride in ecstasy. I recommended the great Goran Stolevski, a film he had not seen, nor had he heard of it, In Search of Anna, a classic by one of my heroes, Esmond Storm. Goran's film, Housekeeping for Beginners, is in Australian cinemas from May 9th. And you should go see it, man. It's freaking fantastic. It's vibrant. It's wicked. It's exciting. It is immersive. And it's probably unlike things that you've ever seen before in terms of where we are physically exploring the world. Housekeeping for Beginners, my highest recommendation. And let me tell you where you can find his picks. Return to Seoul is available for rent on VOD services, and it is on Binge. If you're a subscriber to that, go watch the movie there. Philadelphia Story, it's a classic. You can find it in many places. It's available for rent in all of them. Volver, same thing. And you can watch Volver on SBS On Demand currently at the time of recording. And finally, my staff pick recommendation, In Search of Anna. You'll have to go in search of that movie. It is available out there in certain ways. You can, in fact, buy a DVD of it from the Smart Street Films website, which is what I have done with a few of those very rare films from Hayden Keenan and Esmond Storm, because I admire them. And there's other ways to kind of see it online, but from what I've talked to with Hayden Keenan is that there may be greater ways to see that and experience that film alongside many of these other films in the near future. So keep your eyes on me because I'll be letting you know how to see them when the time comes. But in the meantime, you can also find every single one of these films and every single freaking film ever made and that will be made on the shelves here at cinema's last great hope, the Last Video Store. Physical media, every single one of them. We got them all on DVD, tape, even a few audio mini disc versions, and there's a Betamax of every film. We've got every format available here. Please come support Batuta Video, support me, support the Last Video Store. If you want to support the Last Video Store, great way you can do it. You can give us a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, write something nice about it, say that I'm handsome, and you can confirm if I'm handsome by watching us on YouTube. We are on YouTube. You can look up the Last Video Store. You can look up the Batuta Advocate. You'll find us there, and you can see me talking to these great guests about their favorite movies, and give me a thumbs up, hit the subscribe button, give me a comment about that will raise my self-esteem in a really positive way. I would love all of those things. We're also on Instagram, at Last Video Store Batuta, and probably on X. I think I've set it up, but I've yet to use it. We're on there. You can follow us. I will start using it. And in the meantime, I love you very much, almost as much as I love movies. That's not true. I don't love anything nearly as much as I love movies.